You're listening to New Mexico Filmworks on Talk 1260 KTRC with your host, Dirk Norris.
New Mexico Filmworks is a program of the New Mexico State Film Office brought to you through the generosity of Hutton Broadcasting. We've got a great show for you today with two accomplished screenwriters. In the second half of the show, I'll be speaking with Elisa Valdez, screenwriter, author of 14 books, and director of the Latina Literary Initiative in Albuquerque. But first, I'm very happy to have Dr. Helen Jacy on the phone. Dr. Jacy is a renowned British screenwriter and author, and will be kicking off the Film and Media Day next week, speaking on gender politics in film, Finding the Woman's Voice. Welcome, Helen.
Oh, hi. Hi, Dirk. Welcome. I mean, thank you. Yeah. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks very much. And we're looking forward to your arrival here in Santa Fe. But you're a screenwriter, author, story consultant. How does all that work?
Well, with a lot of juggling, but I think, you know, most of us these days, if you're creative, you find lots of different outlets for that creativity. And I've been really lucky to kind of develop my career as a screenwriter in the UK alongside looking at, you know, what storytellers need, and but working out ways in which I can contribute my knowledge and experience to, like, helping writers think more about areas I'm interested in, like gender and female characters. And as a result of writing my book, The Woman in the Story, I've had been really lucky to go all over the world and meet film organizations, screen agencies in different countries like Australia, Poland. It's been absolutely fantastic. And also meet other writers and directors, filmmakers who, you know, just want to think more closely about what they're doing and why, particularly in their stories with female characters. So it's exhausting, but great and fun. Never a dull moment in my life.
I'm sure. Did you always know you wanted to write, or did that kind of develop over time?
You know, I think I did. I was, you know, really into writing and sort of imagining stories as a child. And then sort of during my teens, I was like, you know, with a lot of teens, I kind of lost the plot, thinking I don't know who I am or what I want to be. And then I think when, after my first degree, my bachelor's in England, I thought, yo, I want to be a screenwriter. And then funnily enough, I sort of went away and did everything but for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I had a kind of very demanding, driven job in international aid. So I was like working in Eastern Europe, working with the orphanage crisis there, mm-hmm. trying to help close down orphanages, running quite big aid programs. Also, I was in Kosovo after the war, which was very harrowing.
I'm sure.
Terrible scenes, terrible devastation of people's lives. But it got to the point where I was thinking, you know what, this would make a great film. And that's when I realized I had to, you know, basically honor my inner internal muse that was really calling and give it up. So that's when I did a master's in screenwriting. And then my life never looked back. And I sometimes think we go around these different sort of journeys to get where we want to be. But I'm never happier than developing and writing a screenplay.
Yeah, I think for most people that journey is very circuitous. There's never a straight line to where you really need to be, I think.
And you do, up to a point, you do need a lot of life experience to know yourself, mm-hmm. and to be truthful and to be able to convey that. And also, you know, to understanding people that comes through the hard knock, you know, lessons of life. And also knowing yourself. However, having said that, I do believe there are some brilliant, really young writers and filmmakers. I'm a big fan of the US series Girls and Lena Dunham, who created that. She's 26 years old. But when I watch it, it's so authentic. It's like, it was like my life in the 20s. Even though it's American New York Girls, I just think, oh, my God, I can relate to that. So I, you know, it's not to say that we all have to be quite, you know, jaded and experienced, but we have to, you know, it's about that. Maybe it's that old head on young shoulders, perhaps, in her case.
Yeah, there's certain, I guess, experiences that kind of are general and speak to everybody, that people can relate to. So did that, your experience in Kosovo, did that end up being a film?
Funnily enough, yes.
How rare.
It was. Actually, it was the second feature film I ever wrote. The first one was based on the Romania orphanage situation. That was a drama. But I did use my experience in Kosovo to write a political thriller. And I actually did that as my master's graduation project. And I loved it. But and it was a great calling card script. It got me, helped me get my agent. And I think with a lot of writers, when you're starting out, you think, oh my, you see Hollywood, the Hollywood sign, you see what stars are going to be in your film when you make it. Mm-hmm. But actually, 9 times out of 10, that script, that first script, A, probably might not get made, but if it does, you're incredibly lucky. But what it will do, it will open doors and it will show the world what you can do as a writer, mm-hmm. and it should reflect your voice. So I was quite happy for it to open the doors that it did. But thrillers, like comedies, they do tend to age. And mine was very, you know, it was at the time when I wrote it, it was 2001, it was very contemporary. And then after about 6 years, you know, it helped me get work. You know, other producers had wanted to work with me because they could see I could write action and thriller. And I looked at it and I thought, well, it is dated now. It's a kind of, you know, slightly historic almost, because it's about a past event, a past war, even though that was 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I said to my agent, you know what, I really want to rewrite it. I want to update it. And War on Terror had kind of really exploded, and our lives have all changed as a result. So I just threw myself into it and did a massive rewrite. And then funnily enough, as a result of that, my agency has packaged it. I've now got a fantastic director attached called Dervla Walsh, and she was here 2 years ago. She won an Emmy for Little Dorrit for her directing that. So she loved the script, really communicate, really connected with her. And now we've just found the right producer. And what terrific. I say to my students, because I also run a master's in screenwriting, I say, you know, this script you're developing here as part of your master's, it could take 12 years, you know, to get going.
Right.
Which is exactly what happened to me. I mean, I do hope it gets made, but, you know, maybe it's a record for the longest script in development ever. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, having that initial exposure, I mean, getting it out there is so very important. And I think that's one of the things for the film industry here in New Mexico and the independent filmmakers we have is you know, finding the opportunity to get your stuff shown.
Yes.
And that's what the importance of having a film festivals and the different venues that people have a chance to get it out there.
Exactly. And, you know, I say to my students as well and other people I meet, you know, don't give up. Tenacity is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And do keep rewriting. Get it as good as you can. And, you know, a lot of writers are quite shy of self-promotion. It's not their natural skill set. We have to spend so much time buried in our laptops and creating these worlds, but then the kind of getting out there and, you know, being sort of, I suppose, really good at selling yourself and talking about it, that's something that we, you know, we have to do, and show it to people, but also be aware that not everyone who reads it is going to be the right fit. You know, I think working with people, you know, you've written something that you want people to understand,
mm-hmm.
and you've got to find the right team, and that, you know, by getting out there and serendipity, I think eventually it will happen. The right people who understand what you're doing will connect with your work.
Right. I've discovered, though, that I don't think creative people are necessarily the best marketers of themselves.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
I know. It's yeah, because, I mean, directors are people who have to control, you know, very big cast of people, you know, the crew, they have to, you know, have natural leadership, or at least, you know, able to, you know, have that sense of command. Mm. And the writer needs to command themselves and their work, but it is an introverted, solitary journey up to a point. And I think that doesn't help us develop the skills that we need to actually be out there and go, actually, you know, I'm an active creator here. I'm an originator.
Mm-hmm.
We feel a bit guilty about doing that. Something that I think all writers need to sort of take some assertive training courses.
Where does that guilt come from?
I think something about the early experiences of writers sometimes exposes us to either too much responsibility or pain that actually in our early lives we're sensitive to that actually is part of the motivation of being a writer. You know, one person crassly put it, the writer's a masochist. I wouldn't go, you know, because it is hard. It is a, you know, it probably sure. is the most challenging process creatively.
Right.
But there is something about sensitivity and needing to work things out, you know, through the written word. And I think for screenwriters in particular, they've got a sort of double-edged sword because you haven't got the freedom of fiction where the rules are less. You know, with screenwriting, you've got a craft. You realize you're getting a script at a certain point where then it will be interpreted.
Right.
But you've also got your vision and all the themes you want to explore. So I guess there is a bit of masochism in being a screenwriter, actually, now I think about it.
Yeah. Well, I think all you creative people are masochists. I mean, you know, the life of a painter is really difficult, too. So I don't think you're alone.
True, and that brings me back to what I said at the beginning. You know, you have to, you know, maximize all your skills. And also, actually, just being a screenwriter is, you know, it's not everything because there are so many ways to explore what you want to say writing. I mean, at the moment, I'm writing my first novel, and I'm actually feeling really liberated by having been writing screenplays for 10 years and also books, and I also write academic books, to actually have this freedom of a novel is like a treat. It's like a reward
We'll get into that in the next segment and find out about your novel. We've got to take a break right now. You're listening to Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. I'm your host, Dirk Norris, and we'll be right back with Dr. Helen Jacy. You're listening to New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio, and my guest is Dr. Helen Jacy, who's going to be here next week kicking off the Film and Media Day, but you're also going to be doing some workshops here as well with New Mexico Women in Film, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm delighted. I'm a member of UK Women in Film, so mm-hmm. I'm always delighted to meet, you know, and work with my sort of fellow sisters across the world.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to that. What I'm doing is a shorter version of I normally do a two-day seminar called Writing the Heroine's Story. This is an evening event, but I'm basically going to try and compress as much of that 2 days into 3 hours and see how we go.
Yeah, that's self-editing, I think, isn't it?
yeah, but it will be fine. And, you know, I usually get a lot of people who are thinking about female characters, working on, you know, they're asking themselves, oh God, you know, is she okay? Is she a stereotype? Is this a cliche? Am I representing women positively through my script? You know, am I pushing the boundaries? Am I, you know, they have kind of dilemmas and queries about female characterization. And so the workshop is really for people to feel empowered mm-hmm. and in control and to create a female character that, you know, well, I think it's important to push the boundaries because so many of our scripts, our stories can kind of, I suppose, let's say, sometimes be unhelpful or not what we wanted to say about reflecting women's lives. And there's always this big question, am I representing the truth? Is this what women's lives are? Or am I, you know, should I actually be showing new ways of being that, you know, women's lives can actually be different? So it's always lots. I think it's more fraught for people when they choose a female protagonist. So the workshop is basically to help them feel in control of their character and their story.
In seeking out that truth, do you think men can write women characters and vice versa? Can women write men's characters?
I really absolutely do believe that. You know, I would feel horrified if people said, oh, you know, your male character isn't authentic. I've written quite a few things with male leads. And I think we're human beings. We live on quite a small planet in the universe. And if you're creative, you probably do have that ability to think and inhabit other characters. I mean, let's face it, if you didn't, you wouldn't have many characters in your stories, right?
Right.
And we wouldn't have, you know, as many successful films written by men and women with different characters. However, what I do think is sometimes I think some of the most sensitive female-driven dramas written by men I'm thinking about The Hours by David Hare, and I'm thinking about, you know, all those groundbreaking stories, Elizabeth. I mean, these are getting on now. But they have a kind of, let's say, I think men are quite good at focusing on the pain of being a woman. And I think women writers want to sort of show the fun and the joy and the love that, you know, being a woman allows. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes male writers focus more on the tragedy and the pain of women's lives. And they do that quite well, maybe because they can observe it. But at the end of the day, I believe we're all capable of creating whatever character we want. You just have to be objective, and you have to be aware of gender, and you have to question your assumptions as well. But that's, you know, but it's very easy. So, you know, I could probably write something like Gangster Squad. I could mm-hmm. think, okay, I'm going to think like a man. I'm going to choose male characters. And I've seen enough crime and action to probably know the elements to put in to satisfy a male audience, because I can see it. I can see it on screen. I can see it on the script. I probably could do it. But then the woman in me would probably want to subvert that a bit somehow. So I'd probably think about all the female characters in that script, and I'd probably think, oh, well, that's where I want to make changes, you know. But when you're thinking about your audience and their you know, what is the primary gender of the audience you're attracting?
Yeah.
You have to make some tough decisions. But I think you can always subvert and you can always push the boundaries, and that's what I really believe in.
You don't think you'd be caught up in writing of the pain of being a man?
Well, interestingly enough, I've been thinking about the pain of being a man quite a lot recently, because I've been looking at the bromance and the bromedy as a genre.
Right.
Because my next book is all about the romantic comedy, but we're looking at how the romantic comedy has really exploded, and has basically, a lot of genres are now sort of blended with romantic comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And romantic comedies have actually changed from the very boy meet girl, Harry met Sally kind of setup, something a bit more open-ended. And we're now looking, I think we want our romantic comedies, if you think about the 5-year engagement, and what I saw the other day, Silver Linings Notebook.
Mm-hmm.
We're more interested in why relationships work and the kind of the pain of them. So they're not all about the kind of cute meet and then the will they, won't they get together, and yes, by act three that they do. I think we're now interested in romantic comedies that really look at why relationships don't work and, you know, our baggage and our pain. I was just thinking about how Bradley Cooper was in Silver Lining Notebook. I mean, you know, so flawed an individual with such pain. But it propelled the romance, and it propelled why he couldn't connect with this woman when it was sort of staring him in the face that she was the right one.
And you think the popularity of this genre is people, like the general public, trying to figure this out for themselves?
Yeah, I think we want to be more real about romance now. Mm. I think over the past kind of 15 years, the world in general, you know, we've been through some pretty huge changes, seismic shifts, really, in terms of, you think about the economy, the adjustments we had to get out of this bubble, all of us in the Western world.
Sure.
The war on terror, the fact that, you know, divorce rates are going up, that, you know, everybody does have, you know, blended families, patchwork families. You know, we want escapism, and we want the happy ending and the fairy tale. But I think sometimes they're not as satisfying as these stories that really do show some truth, you know, more truth than reality.
Right.
So that's a good theme for Valentine's Day, isn't it?
Yeah.
Getting gritty, gritty romance.
Yeah. The veritas of love.
yeah. And it's about identity, you know, because I think we've also become a lot more emotionally literate, and stories mm-hmm. are reflecting that emotional literacy. We really want to understand our characters on a deep level. And I think the kind of old school romantic comedies are slightly more manipulative, let's say, in their storytelling. And I think now that we're more interested in why people are like, you know, why we work and how we work and why our characters are making these decisions, that forces us to make different kinds of stories.
Right. We just have a few seconds left. You're going to be speaking at the New Mexico Women in Film on February 20th.
I am, yes.
And that will be at the Santa Fe Community College. And
that's right.
Then you'll be at the, on the 21st, you'll be kicking off the New Mexico Film and Media Day, and you'll be speaking about the woman role in screenwriting.
That's right. I'll be taking quite a sort of broad look at all kinds of gender politics and ongoing issues that just aren't going away.
Helen, we're really looking forward to you being here. We have to go.
Yeah,
I really appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it too. Bye, Doug.
Goodbye. This is New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio, and we'll be right back with Elisa Valdez. Back. I'm your host, Dirk Norris, and this is New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. You can hear this show streaming on SantaFe.com by clicking on the Talk 1260 KTRC Radio button. You can also hear this and previous shows on podcast by going to SantaFe.com, clicking on the podcast link, and looking for the New Mexico Film Works link. Right now on the phone, I have Elisa Valdez, best-selling author, screenwriter, author of 14 books. Is that correct?
Yep.
Hi, Elisa.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for being on the show. So I just wanted to get a little background. How did you get into writing? How did that progress?
Well, I grew up in Albuquerque, and my dad is a professor. He just retired
at UNM.
At UNM. He's a sociologist, but, you know, professors do a lot of writing. So I kind of just grew up seeing that. And my mother is a poet and creative writer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just something we did in my house. And we didn't have a ton of money when I was really small. My dad was still in school getting his PhD. And to keep me entertained, my mom, I remember it really clearly, she used to play word games with me.
Uh-huh.
And that was just what we did for fun, you know, coming up with similes and metaphors. And it's just always been part of my life.
Uh-huh.
And so I knew probably by the time I was 9 that I wanted to be a writer, and the earliest documentation I have of it is diaries that I kept in my freshman year in high school where I said I wanted to be a novelist. So pretty much my whole life.
Yeah, I think that's for, and I keep saying you creative people, it's part of the DNA, and one way or another, it's going to come out.
I would agree with you. I saw a quote from Alice Walker, the writer, mm-hmm. once, where she said she thinks writers are born with a certain curlicue in their brain that other people don't have. And I kind of agree with that. I'm always stumped when people ask me how they can become writers, because I'm not sure it's something that I would pick.
Right, right, yeah.
Something that picked me.
Right, yeah.
And I don't know if you can become a writer. I think if you're a writer, you already know it, kind of.
Right. If you're a writer, you write. If you're a painter, you paint. If you're a
exactly.
filmmaker, you make films. Yeah.
Yeah.
And of your 14 books, the first one you wrote was Dirty Girls Social Club?
Right.
What is that novel about? Because that's... I see that as being kind of a theme through your life and something you're trying to turn into a film.
Yes. That book has, for one reason or another, been the best-selling book I've had so far. And that's kind of not how you want to do your career. You want to build instead of, you know, lose. But I'm still chugging along. So,
right.
And so because it was such a big bestseller, it's the one that has the most likelihood of becoming a film.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to make any of them into a film or TV series.
Sure.
I kind of envision, you know, my stuff on the screen as I'm writing it. And I'm also a musician, so I have a soundtrack going in my head.
Oh, excellent.
Even as I'm writing my books. But yeah, Dirty Girls it's about 6 women friends in Boston who are all, in the book, they're all 28 years old. For the film or TV version, they're going to be various ages, so we can kind of expand for casting.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're all, you know, what's so-called Hispanic or Latina, And I wanted to show with this group of friends sort of how diverse that population can be, racially, you know, and religiously, you know, ideologically, in every possible way. I wanted to show that nobody is predictable by virtue of belonging to a group of any kind.
Right, kind of breaking stereotypes.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of, I wrote the book in two ways. I had sort of my loftier goal for myself, I think, which was identity, to discuss identity and identity politics and this kind of invented ethnicity, if you will, because there are no Latinos in Latin America. We become that when we come here. Latin America is very, very diverse. Uh-huh. You know, so my dad is from Havana, Cuba, and came to Albuquerque when he was 15. And then my mom is, you know, a native New Mexican of various different backgrounds, and her, you know, so-called Spanish background goes back to the 15th century, as far as we can trace. So I'm the eighth generation New Mexican on her side. So right off the bat, I had a pretty broad sense of what Hispanic meant or Latino meant just in my own family.
And is there a difference between Hispanic and Latino?
You know what? It's such a weird thing. Some people say yes and others say no. It basically means is used interchangeably. Mm-hmm. Hispanic is the word that the government uses, and some people who identify more strongly with their indigenous heritage will say they prefer Latino because Hispanic means Spanish, but I don't see the logic in it necessarily because I don't think, you know, the Native Americans in the Americas were speaking Latin either. But
hardly anybody does anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Soon we will call ourselves something to do with Sanskrit. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all a big mystery to me. Yeah. So I try to examine all of that, kind of the mysteries and the hypocrisies and the complexities of this identity, because it's fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of the loftier goal that I had with that book, but I knew that people probably wouldn't read a book like that if that were all there were to it, or like not a lot of people would read it. So I like to say I wrote a vitamin into a Twinkie, and the Twinkie part is the commercial women's fiction part, which is all about fashion and, you know, sex and friendship and jobs and the things that any woman anywhere and many men can identify with.
And that was with this book?
With this book,
turning
yes.
vitamins into Twinkies.
Right.
You know, I think that's kind of a struggle for creative people. Do they do something that is meaningful to them, or do they do something that they know is going to sell?
Right. I think if you're creative enough, mm-hmm. you can do both.
You can do both, yeah.
Yeah.
You kind of have to if you want to make a living.
Exactly. And it's so funny. I'll get criticized sometimes like that because I'm making a living at writing,
mm-hmm.
which is funny because no one ever criticizes a lawyer for making a living at what they do. Or, you know, there are lots of people who do jobs. And I look at writing, I don't see it as necessarily precious. And I think that's because I spent 8 years, the first 8 years that I got paid to write, I was a newspaper reporter.
Mm-hmm.
In Boston and L.A., and working in newsrooms, you learn to be creative within very strict confines.
Right.
If you have, you know, 11 inches to tell a story, that's how long you write. And if that story is about a fire, that's what you write about. But within those parameters, you can be creative. You can, you know, be original.
Sure.
You can try to find a new way to tell the same story. And you have to do it on a deadline. I mean, I love being in the high, you know, society world of letters now, because everybody talks about the muse and what it takes to get creative and finish your project that you've been working on for 15 years. And I just think back to all of the journalists. Some of the best writers in America are working in newspapers, you know, or they were.
Right.
At the time, one of my favorites is a sports writer named Michael Hawley, who's a phenomenal writer, is a great slam poet. And I don't like sports all that much, but I read everything he wrote, mm-hmm. you know, because it was just amazing. And when you are working in a newspaper for a paycheck and you're on a deadline and you have to have your story in by 4 o'clock, you get your story in. So I come out of that background to novels, and I approach my fiction writing and memoir writing now in the same way that I was trained as a writer in journalism, which is, yeah, you have a headache, you know, you don't feel inspired, maybe you just broke up with your boyfriend, things are terrible, you still go and do your job. You don't really have the luxury not to do it. So
come from a really strong discipline of writing.
Exactly. I think when you think of it as something magical,
mm-hmm.
that's when you run into trouble. You've got to write mm-hmm. even when you don't feel like writing. That's mm-hmm. kind of when some of my best stuff comes out, is when I don't feel like doing it at all.
Do you sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write X number of words today, every day, or?
I do. Well, I think of it in pages.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a few different projects going all the time, so I'm pretty disciplined as far as my schedule. I'm also a single mom, so I have a really small window of when I can work
right.
during the day.
Yeah.
With
Dirty Girls, obviously strong female roles. With your other books, do you have the same? Do you write women characters?
Primarily, yeah, because the genre that I'm in is commercial women's fiction. I wish they didn't divide the literary fiction universe up and nonfiction to a degree into male and female, but they do. And when I say they, I mean big publishing in New York. And that's yeah. just sort of how it's done. It's a little different in other places. England has sort of the equivalent of chick lit for men, which is lad lit, you know, the kind of stuff that Hugh Grant stars in, about mm-hmm. a boy or things like that.
Right.
We don't have a lot of fiction available for men in this country in that kind of vein.
Right.
So I try to stay within the confines of a sellable genre because I don't necessarily want to wait tables.
Yeah, right.
But I do write men. I've been writing more men, and I write, not everything I write is in the first person, but a lot of it is. Like Dirty Girls Social Club is first person all the way through, alternating or switching among six different voices, so mm-hmm. that was kind of challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And in a couple of my books, I've added a male voice into that kind of structure.
Do you seek out the challenge when you're writing a book? Challenging
yeah,
yourself?
I do. I like to challenge myself. I like to step outside of... I think for your first novel, you have to be really personal.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you sell it or not, you've just got to get that part out. And I did that with The Dirty Girls Social Club. There's a lot of me in that book. For my second novel, which was called Playing with Boys, I wanted to step outside of myself and try to write about someone who wasn't like me at all.
And, Alisa, we got to take a break, so we'll
sure.
pick that up in our next segment.
Okay.
This is New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC, and we'll be right back with Alisa. Mexico Film Works. I'm your host, Dirk Norris, and we're talking with Alisa. She was mentioning your second novel.
Yeah, I was just saying with my second novel, I tried consciously to write a lead character who was very, very different from me just to see if I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
As I guess that's kind of the reporter in me, too, like just researching things you don't know anything about and then trying to write like you know what you're talking about.
Right.
So she was very conservative, which I am not, and I had been asked after, you know, in the wake of Dirty Girls to go around giving talks about stereotyping and the dangers of it. And then I had to confront my own prejudices and stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of people did I, as a knee-jerk reaction, dislike or prejudge? And so I wanted to write a lead character who fit many of those qualities.
Right.
And I wanted to love her and bring other people to love her. And I wrote this Republican debutante, you know, born again character from Texas,
which doesn't strike me as being you at all.
It was not me at all, and it worked well enough to get Laura Bush's attention. She liked that book, and she liked that character, and she invited me to the White House to be part of the National Book Fair.
Oh, no
after
kidding.
I wrote it, so I got to meet George Bush and Laura Bush and all kinds of interesting people. So.
That must have been an experience.
I felt like I had succeeded at that task, but then everybody who fell in love with that character was very disappointed to meet me.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what? Okay.
Yeah. You also write men, and I keep asking this question. Is it can women write men's roles and vice versa? Can men write women's roles?
Oh yeah, definitely. Mm. I think anyone who, well, let's say women and men with empathy and compassion and good listening skills should be able to do a good job of writing about anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I would think
that's part of the craft.
Yeah. You can't really be a good novelist if you have no empathy.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really be a good anything if you have no empathy.
I agree.
Like a sociopath.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's, you could be a great axe murderer if you.
Yeah. Politician, maybe. I don't know.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the nonprofit organization you have, Latina Literacy Initiative. What's that about?
Well, I was appalled at the literacy statistics for our country as a whole and for New Mexico in particular. We have, I believe, 47% of the population in New Mexico is functionally illiterate, which is just amazing and sad. Mm-hmm. And when you get into sort of poor areas, it's even worse, of course. So I wanted to create an organization, and I have created it this year, a nonprofit that's going to focus on a few different areas of literacy. On the one hand, I want to be, and we're launching this in September, I'm going to be offering free classes in probably at the National Hispanic Cultural Center. We're meeting next week to confirm the space,
mm-hmm.
donation in-kind space, for women, grown women and older teenage girls to learn to improve their literacy skills. We've got to figure out exactly how to phrase it so it doesn't feel insulting. I think a lot of people who have limited literacy skills learn to hide it really well,
mm-hmm.
and don't necessarily want to step up and say, yeah, that's me, I want to sign up for a class. But there's such a big correlation between literacy and improvements in all sorts of areas in people's lives. Like the number one thing you can do to prevent people who are in prison from coming back once they're out,
right.
is teach them how to read and write.
All kinds of economic benefits.
Benefits like teen pregnancy, like all this stuff.
Yeah.
So there's that. I just feel like it's important to do that. And the reason that it's not limited to Latinas, anybody can participate in our programs. I do want to highlight Latina writers because I feel like there are so many great ones that don't get a lot of attention.
Sure.
And focus in those communities doesn't mean I'm going to be exclusive to those writers either. But I do want to, you know, highlight them. And I also want the program to be bilingual.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be modeled after a program that was pioneered in the nation of Cuba, which my dad's from. And even though we have trade sanctions against Cuba, it is perfectly legal to do cultural and educational exchanges.
Uh-huh.
So Cuba, like, did amazing things with literacy with their revolution. They took a very highly illiterate country and became the most literate country in the Americas, like, overnight. And that was through this program, partly. It's called Yo Si Puedo, which means Yes, I Can. And it's being used in 38 different countries around the world right now. It has been credited with teaching 6 million adults to read and write, mm-hmm. in just the past 10 years. And so they've put together English language materials that are being used in Australia and New Zealand. So we're going to be the first program that's using those materials in the United States. I'm super excited about that.
Excellent.
So that's the first part. But beyond that, I was taking a look at the adult literacy programs that we have in our state right now. And they seem real focused on getting your GED and teaching you how to fill out a job application.
Right.
And I thought that's all obviously wonderful and helpful.
Right.
But I also
limiting.
It's limiting, and I was able to make the acquaintance of Tyler Perry, the filmmaker.
Right.
Whose story is so amazing. He, you know, grew up poor and had a pretty traumatic childhood and was watching Oprah one day. And she said, you know, that the most powerful thing you can do is to keep a journal to
uh-huh.
heal from abuse. And he started to do that. He started to write down everything that happened to him, his thoughts, his feelings, and those turned into plays. And those plays obviously became very popular, and then he parlayed them into film,
right.
and TV. And he is now, like, for the how many, third or fourth year in a row, Forbes top earning man in all of entertainment, which is
right.
incredible. So I felt like I don't think it's enough to just teach people to read and write. I would also like, after that, to offer a full spectrum of literacy services. So we also have a national book club that I've already started this month that's going to keep people reading in communities. We have 15 chapters already across mm-hmm. the country, and we're also doing it online in a forum. So if you're not near a chapter, you can talk to other people there and read reviews of the books there. And I pick a fiction and a nonfiction book every month. So I want to have that going. That's the LLI book club. I also would like somewhere in this coming year to start writers support groups at different levels.
That's
for beginning writers, for adults.
Right.
You know, just to keep people using literacy in ways that aren't just related to getting a job. I think it also to self-expression, to naming your world. You know, in the Bible it says in the beginning there was the Word. You know,
right.
He who has the power to name things has power. That I want people to be able to empower themselves through describing their own experience.
You're going to be a busy gal, it sounds like. Where can people get more information? We've got to go in just a minute here.
Oh, okay. No problem. Everything you'd ever want to know about me, well, most of it, is on my website. It's Alisa, A-L-I-S-A, Valdez, V-A-L-D-E-S, like Sam, .com.
Okay, terrific. Alisa, I really appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Okay. You're listening to New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.